Comrades and friends, hello. This is your Highlands Bunker podcast. We're going to do something a little different tonight. I'll give you a little information about that in a moment. But I want to introduce our guest. Kristen Froelich is a social worker and a therapist here in Delaware. She was also a founding member of the Delaware Citizens Opposed to the Death Penalty all the way back in 92. Was that right? You were a founding member.
I was not a founding member.
No, you were not a founding member. But you were on the board.
But I was on the board for,
Well, we're getting the band back together, and we can start over. Now you're a founding member of this iteration of it. I did want to read something because, you know, we're always on the internet. I'm on the internet. Carl's on the internet. And we're always looking at these about us. Everything's got an about us page. And, you know, everybody's trying to put their best foot forward, and most of them are pretty bad. And the interesting thing about the Delaware Citizens Opposed to the Death Penalty is it's incredibly good. And I want to read it just so people can understand sort of what the concept was sort of at the beginning. Founded in 1992, the Delaware Citizens Opposed to the Death Penalty is a statewide organization that educates the public about the harmful effects of the death penalty and advocates alternatives that affirm rather than denigrate the value of human life. The Delaware Citizens Opposed to the Death Penalty seeks to educate and promote an understanding among Delawareans of the realities associated with capital punishment, focusing on its philosophy and practical inadequacies, while encouraging nonviolent alternatives for the punishment of crime that do not denigrate the value of human life. And of all the about us things I've ever read, I think that's the best one.
Yeah, I like it too. I love that practical inadequacies.
I like that too. Inadequacies, because it was, you know, philosophical and practical inadequacies. It doesn't hold up on either side.
Right, because if we're creating policy and law, it's got to function as intended, and the death penalty does not, has not.
Well, the good news is Sean Lynn, Democrat, Dover, has introduced two bills this session. HB 70 is a death penalty repeal, just repealing the law, as you will, in the legislature. The big one is HB 301. That is a death penalty abolition amendment to the state constitution. Obviously, the threshold is much higher, both in the number of votes that you need and the number of times that you need to pass it. We can do both things at once. Call your legislators and let them know, pass the repeal now, and also vote for the amendment so we can get, you know, we can move into the 21st century. As I said, I wanted to do something a little different. We talked a little bit about it before we turned the microphones on. I think talking about a case study would be helpful in this situation. And luckily, Kristen is an expert in a lot of social work and family social work, and also the death penalty. So we have something sort of interesting that we want to talk about. You were vaguely familiar with Anders Breivik.
Yes, vaguely familiar.
Yeah. So Anders Breivik was a neo-Nazi who did a terrorist attack in Norway in 2011. I think most people know that he got to the campground and massacred a bunch of Labour Party youth at a campground. There's a lot more to it. And I think it would be... I think it's helpful to review this case as a case study for the stuff that we're talking about. So I'll just give a little background and then we can start sort of talking about it. So Breivik was born in February of 79. His father was a diplomat for Norway who had three children from a previous marriage. His mother was a nurse who had a child from a previous relationship. They moved to London. Anders is born. The couple immediately divorce. So before he's one, she's back in Oslo with him. The father's in London. Now, we learn sort of what this relationship was like very early on, because very early on there are interventions, we'll say. There was two official sort of psychological reports. The mom was diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. She was abused as a child and was a teenage single mom and had a kid. She reported that she tried to have an abortion, but the pregnancy was too far along because she thought that the baby was evil and it was kicking her on purpose to make her mad. So right out of the gate, you know, we're not in a good sort of familial situation. However, Child Welfare Services intervenes on this family many times. One time, and again, this we talked a little bit about this. I don't know if these even services are available to lay in the United States. One time they had in outpatient care, the both of them, the mom and the son, for a month. So every weekday for a month, they got this care for 30 days. And then the Norway National Center for Child and Adolescent Psychology writes the report. And I'm like, wow, that's something. They were actually trying to decide whether they were going to grant, like, state, I forget what they called it, respite care. So, like, rather than just foster care, removing the child, there's, like, a middle ground that they were trying to find. Like, okay, maybe we can do respite care and give the mom, like, 3 days off. Like, just get him into a different environment, something like that, which I never heard of. Is that something, like, that's...
I've heard of that with older adults.
Okay.
But I don't often hear about it with younger people. I wouldn't doubt that that's available some places, but it's a temporary measure. And in a lifetime of, you know, mental health issues, it's not enough resources to make lifelong changes. You know, and even a month sounds really like a long time, but it depends what happened during that month. It depends, you know, whether they were able to take in. It depends if they were connected with resources that would extend beyond that month. So, you know, it's not always, the silver bullet that makes the change.
Yeah. A couple of things that came out in the report that was noted in, like, everything I listened to or read about it, was that the mom in front of, you know, people who are assessing their situation would say that she wanted Anders dead. Like, she was dead. But then she would also do the thing where you go from, like, crying and, like, loving, like, too much and then being very angry, that move. But the thing that comes up in all of the stuff that I read was, at this time, somebody noted that Anders was totally disconnected from, like, emotion, didn't cry when hurt, smiled at, like, the wrong times, and it was disconnected. I think it said something like the smiling that was disconnected from emotion. And when you're, like, a four-year-old, you know, that's not a good sign. So there was tons and tons of assessments. There was a foster couple who reported, the police report's undated, so we don't know exactly. We think, let me check my note. So this would have been when Breivik was about 4 or 5. The mom takes him to the foster care and says that he should be able to look at and touch the man's penis. Because his dad's not there. His dad's in London, and he doesn't see that, so he doesn't know what that is. So he should be able to do that. And I just thought that whole, like, because there was a bunch of stuff that I had read that said that she put sexual imagery onto, and I couldn't really understand what they were saying. I think they were referring to stuff like this.
Yeah, it sounds like a long history of trauma.
Yeah.
Probably both in the mother's life and in the child's life.
Yeah.
And that that can make lifelong changes unless it's treated and healed.
Yeah, so eventually there is a hearing, and basically the child welfare services are basically saying, hey, look, you know, we talked to the nursery school, he's doing all right. You know, maybe we can just, you know, just continue with this respite stuff. Like, I sort of understand that, because even nowadays, if you're having this conversation, you can imagine in your mind talking to a social worker or somebody from, you know, the Health and Human Services or child welfare, and them thinking, like, I'm going to try to do everything I can to sort of keep them together at least. Maybe there's something to that. You know, so I sort of understood that. Now, the medical people, the people from the National Center for Child and Adolescent Psychology, were like, oh, no. This is not gonna fly. And so there is a hearing. They decide to go with the more moderate measure. It's not really followed up on. I think he only did, you know, a few months maybe of these kind of visits and got sort of that that social service, and then it was just over.
Yeah, and respite, it might be helpful to the child, but it's really giving the parent a break. And who knows if the child's needs were being met during that respite.
So into his teenage years, it's sort of like classic rebellion. He becomes he's big into like graffiti art and like video games, things like that. This is when they assume he developed most of his, you know, far right extremist sort of, you know, fascist, anti-immigrant, all this stuff sort of ideology. But he starts running in trouble with the state again. And so he's getting arrested for graffiti and resisting arrest and stuff like this. And they're trying to, again, figure out if there's some services or something can be done about this. The father at this point, they separate. There's some contention about whether the father was like, I think at one point, because there was going to be this hearing, He tried to get custody, full custody at one time, and wasn't granted it. I don't know if that was because he lived out of the country. I have no idea. But now it gets to when he's doing sort of like low-level, like, teenage criminal stuff, mischief, that they split. Now, the father says that he never called him again. They say the father said, I disown you. So there's some disagreement about who said what. But anyway, the father's not in his life ever again from the age of like 13 or 14, 15, maybe something like that. And again, nothing really comes of it. There's no, nothing could be done really. You know, you think of all the services and again, they went through, you know, a bunch of different legal stuff, like in the juvenile courts when he was doing like low level stuff. Just didn't take. So we could skip over most of the gruesome stuff. He finally starts a computer business and makes a little bit of money. It's a little bit weird, but he finally just goes off into rural Norway to pretend that he's become a farmer, like a potato farmer. And he amasses what he needs to sort of do the act, plans it all out. He funds a lot of it on credit cards. He's actually, it's so goofy, he goes to Prague to try to buy illegal arms, and he can't, because it's like he doesn't really, he's just a guy, he can't, you know, didn't know how to do it. So he goes back to Norway and just bought legal guns. He bought a 9mm pistol, because he went to a pistol club, he joined the club, he took the training, got the pistol. And so they have these pretty strict laws there, but you can get guns. And so, and then he was, because he was out in the rural area, he got a hunting license and went and got the license and paid for that so he could get a semi-automatic rifle. He just amassed what he needed to amass. And then on July 22nd of 2011, what he did first, which people don't really remember or wasn't really well reported at the time, at least in the U.S., was he did a car bomb, a truck bomb, sort of a la like Oklahoma City. It wasn't as strong, but it was basically the same thing, fertilizer truck bomb. He obviously bought tons of fertilizer because he was pretending to be a farmer. Now, luckily, one of the things, and Carl will also appreciate this, as awful as the truck bomb was at a government building where the PM's offices were, it was July 22nd in Norway, so like nobody was there. It was everybody was on holiday, and so you know, luckily, I think 20 or 25 people were killed. But that building was, they said, you know, two thirds or three quarters empty. Thank goodness. So what happened was he used that as a diversion. They have him on CCTV in like full cop riot gear, because that was the other thing too. And it seems like he got this from his mom in some fashion, and not to get all Freudian, but like they reported that he was always real tidy. Even when he was like 3-4, he was real tidy because he didn't want like his mom to say he was messy, because his mom always said he was a mess and hard to handle. So when he got older, he was all into like the neo-Nazi stuff, but you got to look tough. You get different uniforms, you button them up, you take pictures of yourself, or you take pictures of yourself with your guns and stuff like that. So he was way into that. So he's dressed as a cop. He hops in a car, goes out of Oslo. Building blows up. He drives about 40 minutes to a lake, Utøya Lake, where there's a Labor Party, the kids of the Labor Party having a summer camp. He gets there. He says, I'm a cop. I got to go check on them because of the explosion. You guys heard about the explosion, right? And they were like, yeah. He's like, you got to let me over there. So the ferry takes him over, and, you know, he just proceeds to be like, hey, I'm a cop. Everybody come here. Just, you know, massacre. I think about 50 people, mostly kids. A lot of people were able to escape into the water. There's a lot of cool stories. If you want to at least find something good out of this, there was camp. So this was like an island, but there were campsites on the other side of the lake, and like other campers and just like regular guys would come over in boats and were taking people out of the water and just trying to save as many people as they could, just like private boats. It was wild. So finally, the cops come and he lays down his rifle, because they were like, "Hey, we're gonna kill you if you don't put it down right now." So he just put his rifle. They said he paused or whatever and just put it down. And they just took him like that. Before the trial, obviously, there was, again, conflicting reports about whether, you know, is he fit to stand trial? Is he not fit to stand trial? What does it mean to be, like, you know, to have these disorders but do this? Is it, like, you know, totally complicated. I don't know how they even adjudicate something like that. Because they came back originally and said, oh, no, you know, he's not fit to stand trial. And then the next group sort of said, well, yeah, definitely has these serious mental illnesses. And obviously all the stuff we talked about was documented. They knew the history. It wasn't, you know, they didn't have to do too much detective work. You know, he's been in the system, so to speak. But they were like, yeah, he's bad, but he can stand trial. So he does stand trial. The maximum sentence for anything in Norway is 21 years. You have to serve 10, and then they reassess. It's not like parole though. Like if you didn't do anything, you're out. Like you don't have to prove anything. You don't have to go and like, you know, do a sob story. It's just like if you did the time, you can go. Now, Breivik has stayed in a few different places. But the place that he has sort of landed in now and stayed in the longest is in Ringerike prison. It's just Norway. It's tough. This Scandinavian stuff's tough. But his accommodations right now are sort of like in a separate building, totally separate. So he lives separate from the prison itself. He lives in like a couple room suite. It's like a bedroom, bathroom, and shower. He can keep. He has at different times kept like parrots as pets. Has a small gym inside. He famously, because he's a gamer, He famously complained in one of his appeals that he wasn't, he had the PlayStation 2, but he wasn't upgraded to the PlayStation 3, and those were all kids' games, and he couldn't get the good games, which, I mean, I'm not a gamer, but I'm sure people listening to this can sympathize with that. There's an outdoor area, basketball hoop, but the fact is that he is isolated. His mother did visit him until her death, I think about 5 years ago. She was the only person that was able to visit him, like, in person, no screen or anything. He has had a few visitors here and there. At once, I read something in a book, and I didn't get a chance to, like, verify it, but it's just a funny story that he was able at one point to meet the other person. At one point, there was another person. So there was another suite in that building that was totally cut off that another person was in. And they let them, like, play cards a few times or just, like, have, like, an hour to sort of, like, you know, just do recreation. And the other inmate was like, nah, I'm good. I don't need to talk to that guy. So it kind of tells you a little bit about his personality, I suppose. But the thing that is interesting to me is that not only is this the accommodation, he continues to appeal because, you know, I'm sure that kind of isolation does not feel good. You know, yes, he does have access to a small library as well, but that isolation can't feel good. But
yeah, you know, I imagine he felt just such a loss of control and agency and independence too.
Yeah. So. Not only, you know, is that his conditions, living conditions, take it for what you will. Norway is still adjudicating appeals. You know, is he in handcuffs too long? You know, is there other accommodations we should be making? Pretty much the answers are no. but they're listening to the appeals. There's a process for them to sort of kind of come to terms with, like, even these appeals actually are held in, like, a gymnasium and part of the prison. Like, he can't, I mean, obviously he can't go anywhere. The guy's proven to be absolutely a danger, a menace, and wound up killing the death toll from the bombing and the island was 77.
Yeah, I can hear the outraged screams of people in the United States over something like that, who would be demanding, you know, his head on a plate, because we treat murder so differently here.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I'll take it a step further. I think we treat the responsibility that we have to, like, society, like, we all make it up. So if it's all of us doing it, we have sort of a responsibility for it, because what you're doing is impacting it. And when you have a total disregard for that responsibility, then it doesn't really matter. They're like, well, that guy killed somebody, so now he's dead, so that's that. Well, that's a cope. That's what the kids these days call a cope. Like, that doesn't mean anything. It's philosophically inadequate.
Practically inadequate.
Yeah, and then obviously practically is, yeah, killing the person doesn't, yeah, yeah, like, that doesn't, like, yeah, okay, he won't kill anyone or she won't kill anyone anymore. Okay, well, what does that mean, though? Like, what does that say about how we're supposed to operate? I don't get that. That's not necessary. If it's not necessary, we can come to that, and again, I wish I remembered the wording from that about us. We can come. There's other remedies that we can get to the same result without debasing ourselves.
Yeah, and I think the pieces I'm struck by is that they have a baseline of humanity, that we want to operate from humanity in any choices that we make. I'd be really interested to see what they do for family members who've lost a loved one. You know, what are the goals? We tend to not focus very much on our goals. Like, are our goals safety? Are they support for victims' family members? Are they just punishing the person who committed the murder? We tend to be very narrow in our goals in this country.
Too difficult.
And people don't really follow through on them.
Yeah.
You know, I hear accountability, but what accountability means to me is not just that the person loses their life or their freedom. It's have they really made a psychological change? And can they really personally take ownership of how they've harmed other people? We talk about restorative justice quite a bit, and that takes a much broader view. The person who committed the crime, the person who was, you know, people who were victims of the crime, the community, the collateral people who were involved in any process, legal or otherwise. So you get a lot more input about accountability, about what are the harms, who was harmed, what can we do about it, who is responsible for restoring or healing the harms. So there's a lot more flexibility. You have to think more. You have to really, take responsibility for, you know, what are we really doing here? And not just kind of go into an automatic person does bad thing, we kill person, which is how we often handle it or have handled it here in the United States.
Yeah, it's a way to completely turn your back on having to think about any of the things you just said because it's too hard. I talked about this a little bit before we turned the microphones on, and this was mentioned in more than one thing that I read. There was a sense among Norwegians, because once the story comes out that we just talked about, it's like, you know, we have this social safety net for a reason. Like and within this, you know, we failed originally because we weren't able to sort that out. Now that's not an excuse for anything, but people did think that way. Like the reason that maybe an American would think that the accommodations in which Breivik is kept are too cushy or too expensive or whatever. But that's not how they look at it.
Yeah. Recently I read something. They'll compare, the victim didn't get to live, so the person, you know, the killer shouldn't get to live. And, you know, we try to smush it all together, which means that we lose sight of finding other ways to honor the victim's life or protect people going forward. We sort of think if we haven't annihilated the killer, we haven't done anything. I'm a sister of a murdered brother, and I don't think my brother's worth or value has anything to do with the fate of his killer at all. I don't know. That wasn't my focus. And I feel like it's detrimental to family members to think that, you know, whether we treat someone with humanity or annihilate them has anything to do with the value of their loved one. That doesn't make any sense to me. And yet we do that all the time. I hear that all the time.
Yeah. Well, this is probably a good time to go into the third act. So, you did mention that your brother was killed, was murdered. I knew that part. Obviously, you've worked with Kevin O'Connell in the past and know him. And I knew that part of it. I mentioned to you that I didn't investigate the details of it. I feel like when I listen to people's stories, I like them to be able to tell me what they think is relevant and why they think that context is important. I know that this is a story that it's like the worst story, but you have to tell it over and over again. And I want to respect that. So, yeah, But I do think it says so much about, you know, the issue.
Yeah,
so.
I'm comfortable telling my story. It's part of the healing process for me. I was watching the news last night, and they were saying today is the April 19th is the anniversary, the 29th anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing. And my brother was killed on April 18th. And I thought, 29 years, that's remarkable. He was only 22 when he died. It was in Connecticut, and he shared an apartment with two other young men, also in their early 20s. A fourth was staying with them, and a fifth, was over at the time. They'd had some difficulties with their landlord, but no one suspected the extent of the violence that would happen. So on April 18th, their landlord shot and killed all five of them. It was a small town in Connecticut, close-knit communities, just stunning news. And then, of course, the very next day, the Oklahoma City bombing happened. So just, the violence and just the devastation, loss of life was just beyond belief. No one teaches you how to respond. So we're sort of floundering, grieving, feeling confused, just trying to figure things out, trying to get some answers. And then, the killer was caught, within a few days he fled. But within a few days he was caught. And then originally it was a capital case. Under those circumstances, you can see the reasoning why it would be assigned. It was, mass murder. So, we're sort of, we don't know what to do. We don't know how to proceed as family members. But you want to trust something. So the legal system shows up. You think they know what they're doing. You think they know what the right thing to do is. So we think, they're telling us this is how we proceed. This is what's going to happen. We think, that sort of makes sense. Although they never asked us what we wanted. We never got really an opportunity to think about it, at least formally in that context. So, because it was a death penalty case originally, it took more time, more investigation. They, higher standard of proof. So this is going on, leaving us all kind of in limbo. We're sort of hoping something's gonna proceed to give us some legal finality, which would have helped to be able to shift focus to grieving, to really fully grieving in a personal way. That legal piece really takes over the whole thing and kind of hijacks the emotional experiences.
Yeah, it's like a Kafkaesque.
People.
You're caught in a
yes.
You're caught in like
yes.
a procedural and an administrative
yes.
procedural
yeah.
thing. Meanwhile,
yeah.
there's an emotional
right.
thing not being
right.
not being addressed.
And the procedural piece, the legal piece, civilians don't have any say or control over. We listen. We sort of hope for the best. We wonder what's going on. Come to find out later, they dropped the death penalty. I don't know exactly what the reasons for that were, but and by that time, I expect, although I can't remember, I probably would have come to the conclusion that I wasn't looking for the death penalty and that I wouldn't have wanted the death penalty, but. It's sort of, again, having the rug pulled out from under you. Here's what we're led to expect. Here's something we can, kind of lean on in terms of process. When people say we're doing this for the victims' families, I think that's absolutely absurd. That process was absolutely not for me or for my family or the other families. It was something that was set up, you know, in law, policies and procedures, but it was not designed to support victims' family members. It was not designed to ask us what we wanted or needed. It was not designed to educate us about what the choices were or what would happen. And so, you know, to this day, I don't see those pieces included in either capital cases or other cases of violent crime. We have some services available for victims of crime, but with something as big as capital crime and you're not talking to the victims' families at length and giving them choices, including them in decision-making, that's harmful. It's disrespectful. And so I really want to see something, you know, built in. There was a bill introduced to bring back the death penalty not too many months ago. And I just felt so angry because I thought they're coming up with this as if it's an answer that will heal and I don't know, create safety or create some benefit. And I thought they're still not going to tell people about the harms or the practical, I forget what the phrase was in that about.
Yeah, the philosophical and practical inadequacies.
Yes, those practical and philosophical inadequacies.
The thing is that
those are real.
The two things you mentioned earlier about, you know, being stuck in a process, an administrative process, and not dealing with the emotional part of it. The state, the prosecutors generally, this is my view, they're only stuck in that, right? I think when they say, you know, victims, families, or you know, we've got to remember the victims or whatever, you know, to whatever extent they might feel that individually, I think that there's more, that's just a posturing thing to get sympathy for them to go in and use the power of the state. I think that's a manipulation.
Yes.
And I don't think they care actually necessarily what you would want or think. I think within a very narrow sort of parameter, but they're there to sell you on what they think they can do and then tell you, well, is that, how's that? If they even communicate with you at all.
Yeah, I think that's true sometimes. I don't want to say that's true exclusively. I think some of them really believe this is helpful to the victims' families, but they're seeing it through the lens of this is all we got. This is all there is. Instead of thinking, wow, what outside of this legal system could possibly be helpful to people who've been through an incredibly traumatic event and have to go on living and don't want to be connected to the person who hurt them the most for the rest of their lives, don't want to have to relive every gruesome detail of the most painful experience of their life. It doesn't occur to them to think outside the legal system because we don't talk about that. We don't say, how can we honor these people? How can we support them? How can, you know, what would restitution look like? What would healing look like? You know, those conversations are starting to happen, but it'd be great if the legal system could recognize that and steer focus toward that and not claim this is going to heal you or make you feel better or do something for you. It isn't for a few people. Executions may satisfy something, but there are very few executions after murders for good reason. There should never have been a lot. But they don't tell people that. They don't tell you what's going to happen. They don't tell you how long it's going to take. So I think they are trying to sell people a bill of goods.
Yeah. And again, I think the other important responsibility or benefit is to all of us. because you have a very sad experience, personal experience, that the majority of people won't have. That's why it's important to sort of really reflect on what you're saying. On the other side of it, someone like me who hasn't had that experience, I watched something. It's on YouTube. The comedian John Oliver, his show is actually has some pretty good journalism sometimes, and he's done a bunch of death penalty pieces. Maybe we'll link to it. He tracked down the company that's compounding the chemicals to do chemicals. Because, as people probably know, the lethal injection chemicals are difficult to get because nobody wants to sell it. Because if you sell it, you know, people will be like, that's gross. So already the population knows not to do this for the most part. So then some states passed laws that said, well, we'll do it in secret and we won't tell you where we get it from. Well, they were able through, you know, some journalistic, gum chewing, to figure out that this chemical company in Connecticut, that makes actually chemicals to clean like industrial equipment is compounding the chemicals that like, I think they're compounding the chemicals that they did the federal that Trump did all the federal executions, or maybe the one that Alabama just did. I think maybe it was the one that Alabama just did. And I think to myself, what word did you use in the about us? Denigrate. It just denigrate. It makes us look like animals. Like, why are we going through this process to murder somebody?
Right.
It debases American society.
Yes, humanity is out the window. And I keep coming back to, what are we trying to do? This is public policy. This uses taxpayer dollars. What are we trying to do? Is it effective? Are we trying to create more safety? It is not effective. Are we trying to support victims' family members? Not effective. We're getting, in the history, modern history of Delaware's death penalty, over 70% of death sentences did not end in execution. So we're paying all this money, even for the people who want executions, that are not getting them. And yet we're just hell-bent on, let's keep this process going that does not work.
Yeah, I think that's the key, is that we know there's no, you know, it doesn't really help the victims in their grief and in their recovery. It doesn't do anything for sort of like deterrent. We know that. This has been studied up and down and all around. So there's nothing. The only reason is for this sort of like, it's half revenge, half cope. It's half like, okay, nobody's really going to argue because it's a bad person. And also that way we don't really have to think about anything else. Because I don't really think the money, you know, people say, oh, he has a Andres Breivik has a stationary bike. Well, you know, how much money it costs to try these and to do all of the stuff. The administrative costs are huge. So, you know, it's not really that. It's just the easy way out. And I think people need to be confronted. And now's a good time to do it. With the bills in the House that we talked about, to confront this and say, what end are we trying to achieve? There are alternatives to that. If the end you're trying to achieve is for that person not to kill anyone else ever, we can work on that without just like becoming subhuman.
That's right. Without losing our own humanity.
Without losing our own human. We can get to the end line you want. Without losing our own humanity.
Yes.
That's
yes.
Right.
Yeah. Every single thing. There are other ways that will be more effective, less expensive, more humane. I think you're absolutely right that it's kind of a knee-jerk response. It's psychologically so uncomfortable that we really, you know, take this immediate reaction and run with it rather than letting ourselves kind of work through those emotions, as painful as they are. This is me wearing my therapist hat. and, you know, really struggling with what do we need to heal? You know, what would that feel like? What does healing, you know, people who commit violence look like? What does healing people who've experienced or been victims of violence look like? What does it look like to heal our society? You know, we don't look very much at prevention. So I think we've got to do some of that hard work. I think we owe it to ourselves and each other.
I believe that too. Like, I think we owe it to everybody to take that responsibility for like what we should be doing. Because I do think it is the, I don't want to get too corny or trippy dippy or whatever, but I do think there's something about it. Like if you just live in a society that sort of allows that, sort of allows people to like take the easy way out like that and be like, ah, just do that. Yeah, that portends other problems. Because we had a bad mindset, for lack of a better explanation. You know, we don't look at each other the same. We don't look at, for example, unhoused people or people rough sleeping on the street the same, because because we're okay with one thing, we can like people's humanity is like a sliding scale now. And it's not really a sliding scale. Everybody's at 100. That's it. And it allows us to do other things too, when you allow that.
Yeah, I think that would free us up to be so much more creative. I think the lack of imagination is astounding, that we so often think of death or criminalization as solutions. I think, gee whiz, if we would let people use their creative powers, we could come up with anything, you know, that would help us thrive and keep us safer. And I just think it's such a lost opportunity.
Well, we have an opportunity right now. We have the death penalty repeal, HB 70, on the table. Everybody's got to get behind that. Because, again, yes, it's the lesser of the two moves. But in Delaware, it's still a big move if it can be statutorily repealed. But really what we want is HB 301. We want the death penalty abolished in Delaware by constitutional amendment. It'll just make us all feel better. That's how I'm pitching it.
Yeah, and we've gone since 2016, when the Delaware Supreme Court deemed the death penalty statute unconstitutional. You know, we've had 8 years where we haven't had to experience that false promise of like, this is going to heal you and this is going to, you know, keep you safer and this is going to be the right thing to do. We've been free of all that pretense. So I'm hoping that it's given people an opportunity to say, you know, what can we do about prevention? What can we do to support victims of violent crime that doesn't have anything to do with losing our humanity and killing other people? So I'd love to keep that going perpetually.
Folks, let me tell you something. I think I've probably mentioned this before. The head of the Office of Defense Services, Kevin O'Connell, we both know. This is his life's work. He's on this like bees on honey, we'll say. I was going to say something else, but I'm not going to say it. Kevin, I'm keeping it clean for you, buddy. A lot of the folks who were originally part of the organization are getting back into it. These bills are going to be a big rallying point for that. So I hope people sort of get on board and push for this, because I really do think it's necessary to take the step is necessary just to get us to back to square one. We shouldn't be doing this. We need to stop for all of the reasons we said.
Yeah.
And that's it.
I'd encourage, can I say one more thing?
Of course.
I'd encourage people to do some homework on it. We have a website, www.enddeathpenaltyde.org, O-R-G. That's the Delaware Citizens Opposed to the Death Penalty website. It has some, you know, basic information. It has links to resources. Death Penalty Information Center is a national organization that has tons of resources about, you know, the racial aspect, the innocence aspect, you know, whether it's effective in policing. So I encourage people to go deep on this rather than stay on that surface level. Something, things that feel okay on the surface can be quite different if we let ourselves go deep. That's doable. We have that information. We have that research.
That's so important because that's the way you're talking about, like, this avoidance, like, mm-hmm. we're going to do this. The only way to challenge that is to go deep.
Yeah.
Is to say, actually, it doesn't help law enforcement. It's not a deterrent. It doesn't do this. It doesn't do that. It, you know, and it costs this money. Like, to be able to challenge, because there's this avoidance, this cope needs to be challenged because it's degrading us.
Yeah.
And that's the way to do it. Is to really get yourself together and be able to challenge some of these just avoidance tactics, really.
Yeah. Yeah, we have to be brave enough to do it. We have to be brave and humane enough to do it. We need to be more, not less. These are people's lives. You know, it's their families' lives. It's the murder victims' families' lives. It's the people who are involved in executions lives, you know, that stuff is important. We can't just say, oh, this is the way to do it without really thinking it through or taking, you know, responsibility for learning what the reality is, what the practical realities are and inadequacies.
That's right.
Yeah. We can do it. We can do it. And then we can devote our energy and our money and our time to anything we want, anything else we want. We deserve that.
Kristen, thanks for doing this.
You're welcome. My pleasure. Thank you for having me. Thank you.
I'm glad we did it. Folks, that's all we have for today. But we'll have more for you next week. And as always, I mentioned on the last episode about this big 300th episode coming up. And I had something in mind I was working on, and it looks good. I got confirmation today it's on, and I'm not going to tell you what it is yet. I should make it patrons only, really, but maybe I won't. We'll see how many of you continue to support Left is Best.